Good evening, everyone, and this is Nightcap. Welcome to this Valentine's Day Nightcap premiere. This new thing of ours. We'll be here for you political junkies every Saturday evening at 11 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. It can be our little secret for now. So every Saturday night, you can make yourself a pitcher of your favorite adult beverage, grab a six-pack, a bowl of chocolate guacamole, some red peppers, chips, prosciutto, mozzarella maybe, and off we'll go for what will become our regular Saturday night thing. So we can make this yet another opportunity to tick off some lists, so you might want to light up a cigar, add some extra salt to your chips, and don't forget that I'll be turning the heat way up in the house, so you can sit around in your jammies and your shorts and be all toasty and turn up all the lights and give it to the fascists one more time in one more way. Thank you all for being here, and let's go. First, let's have cut to a little ad, a little something done by Move America Forward, and it talks about something that we have to do to promote keeping Gitmo open.
Guantanamo Bay, where America imprisons terrorists, including the alleged mastermind of 9/11, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. But President Obama has ordered Gitmo closed with no plan for the prisoners. He may even bring terrorists here, Fort Leavenworth, Charleston, Camp Pendleton. Even Obama now admits...
Of course I'm worried about it.
Keep terrorists locked up at Gitmo, not here. Sign the petition at moveamericaforward.org before it's too late.
Absolutely. I'm not sure that he'll be listening, but we can sure shout loud enough. If he's not listening, maybe we'll make those Congress critters nervous. Nervous enough to ask. They'll be begging him to back out. They want to be reelected in 2 years. He's got four to make us forget or to kill us. So get over to Move America Forward and sign that petition if you haven't done it already. And try to spread the word and get your friends to do it as well. This week we have the great Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Kukulu, Vietnam vet and author of a new book that I've talked about before, and he's already been my guest on Freedom Radio. Colonel Kukulu conducted scores of private interviews of servicemen and civilians alone with no command oversight. Detainees are fed 4,000 calorie halal prepared meals each day. They get special treats for Muslim feast. A detainee at Gitmo receives medical attention on an average 4 times a month. More than me. Do you think we're going to get 4 times a month under the new Daschle health plan? I don't think so. We're about to welcome our guest, Lieutenant Colonel Gordon Kukulu, author of Inside Gitmo. Welcome to Nightcap, Colonel.
Hey, Pat. Great to be on with you tonight. Thanks for having me.
Oh, it's always a pleasure. I guess you're hearing a little too much from me these days, but it just doesn't seem like we can get the word out there thoroughly enough.
No, never can do too much of with you guys. I always enjoy it with you and feel like we're really connecting to the audience, and I think that's very important. And I'm proud of the work that you all are doing, and delighted to be just a small cog in the wheel. So thanks for having me on.
Well, hardly small, but thank you for being here. And we have, I noticed that having read bits of your article on the 24th, also there is an article in the Long War Journal, Yemen Strikes Multifaceted Deals with Al-Qaeda. My lips aren't working today. Not connected to the brain for some reason. Anyway,
not a problem.
Yemeni President Ali Saleh, that's how I'm pronouncing it anyway.
You're right.
Saleh recently struck a deal with Zawahiri, and Yemen is in the process of emptying its jails of known jihadists. The Yemeni government is recruiting these established jihadists to attack its domestic enemies as it refrains from serious counter-terror measures against the newly formed Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Very tricky for them, Colonel.
The whole thing is a can of worms, Pat. And
yeah.
I think that that's one thing, I guess just to establish a baseline for the listeners, you know, part of all of our problem here is that we tend to look at foreign cultures and these terrorist movements, especially through our own cultural lens. And, you know, it's a natural human thing to do. We tend to put these things in our own perspective in order to compartmentalize and understand them. And so, you know, for us, when you're a member of something or when you join something, typically you have a card, you have a, you know, you may have a lapel pin, you get emails, you go to meetings and all this kind of stuff. If you're an international terrorist, it doesn't necessarily work that way. And very few people actually run around with a, do you know who I am? Well, I've got my Al-Qaeda card here with me to, I don't leave home without it kind of thing. And a lot of these groups are very amorphous. One of the things that I note in the book Inside Gitmo, when I do a couple of chapters worth of case histories on these guys, is how boundaryless internationally that terrorism is. And it's quite a phenomenon. In other words, many of these people cut their teeth with the Kosovo Liberation Army, with the LET in Pakistan. They fought in Chechnya. They may have fought in Somalia. They may have been in and out of places like Iraq, Iran, Syria, Lebanon with Hezbollah, in North Africa with the, particularly in Algeria and Morocco with the Al-Qaeda groups or other terrorist groups there. Some of them have come from Abu Sayyaf in the Philippines or Jamiah Islama in Indonesia. They come from all over. I mean, we even had an Australian, David Hicks, there. Listeners will remember Johnny Walker Lynn, who was mistakenly labeled the American Taliban. He wasn't Taliban, he was Al-Qaeda. And the what we see with all of these people is that there's an amorphous transnational nature to their membership and to their activities. They tend to gravitate toward where the fight is. They tend to gravitate toward where the measures against them are weakest. Hence, when Somalia cracked down on bin Laden, where'd he go? He went to Afghanistan, cut a deal with Mohammed Omar, and they ran Afghanistan together for a while. Now that he's out of Afghanistan, or, you know, if he's still alive, Ayman al-Zawahiri, certainly they're in Waziristan. And that's how these guys move around. And so we get too fixated on, well, gee, was this person a particular member of a group, or what's this country's policy like? And the countries pretty much with these authoritarian governments are the same way. I mean, you're my friend today, you're my enemy tomorrow. And so what we've seen in Yemen particularly is that it's been a revolving door for terrorists. It's been a breeding ground, a petri dish, if you will, for terrorists. Many of the attacks that have come against the United States and other European countries have come from, have been generated by leadership in Yemen. And of the 240 some odd, somewhere in that number of detainees that are still at Guantanamo, perhaps 100 or so are Yemenis. And Yemen is now telling President Obama, well, you know, maybe we'll take these guys back. Well, if we take them back, it'll get them out of Gitmo, but it's just going to return them to the fight. They'll be in the front door and out the back door before you know it, and they'll be back in the fight. And so I think this is something that the listeners need to realize, that why there's no easy solution for closing Guantanamo, and why sometimes the simplistic solution of, well, we'll just turn them back to their home countries really doesn't work.
And isn't it true that already a high percentage of formerly held terrorists in Gitmo were already returned to Yemen and already released? And is it the number two Al-Qaeda fellow is already free in
Al-Nashiri is the number two in Yemen, is a Guantanamo graduate. He even went through the Saudi rehabilitation program because he's a Saudi national. He was He managed to convince the military authorities in Guantanamo that he was an innocent carpet merchant, and a few months later was back in the fight. He brought along with him one of his Guantanamo buddies, another Saudi who had successfully fooled the military authorities at Gitmo into thinking that he had only gone to Afghanistan to assist refugees. So these are just a few of the more than 60 that the Department of Defense and Justice have identified as former Guantanamo detainees going back to the fight. And lo and behold, last week we learned from the Saudis that they've got 85 guys on the watch list, on their be on the lookout for list, and of them, at least 11 are former Guantanamo detainees. So what we're seeing here is that the recidivism rate, which is marginalized by a lot of anti-Gitmo activists, is really considerably higher than what we what these numbers will display. And part of what the reason for that is, a lot of the authorities are very conservative in giving these numbers. They're not going to give them out unless they know that the person in question really is, has been a recidivist. So I suspect that, we're going to see the majority of these guys go back. I think the number that have actually successfully reintegrated society is unfortunately very low, and there was a reason they were in Guantanamo in the first place.
There was a great article on your website, InsideGitmo.com. I loved it, and it was not that the news was terrific, but the actual article was one of those not written by you, but it was Jihadi Rehab Playing with Finger Paint or Fire.
Mm-hmm.
Great article.
That's a really interesting article, and we posted another really good one today from Canada, from the Globe and Mail, on there. And I urge the listeners, when you have time, to surf over to InsideGitmo.com and check it out, because, we pretty much, Pat, as post something new every day, and so it's a really alive website, and it's worth coming back to several times. You'll always
it is. Everything you need to know about Gitmo and then some. Too bad Obama hasn't found it yet.
Pat, are we still connected?
Yes.
Oh, okay, sorry.
I don't know what that was.
We had a little hiccup there, but...
Yeah,
I wish he would, and I recognize the president's not going to sit there surfing on his BlackBerry to call up different websites, but certainly he's got people working for him that ought to get smarter about this, because maybe some of them are, to be fair.
Yeah.
In the campaign he had made promises that really frightened me, because it sounded like what he was going to do was, issue an order on Tuesday for Guantanamo to be emptied on Friday. And he did not do that, and I was happy to hear that he allowed at least a year, and then fudged that even more a few days later. That year promise was done with when he was in an interview with George Stephanopoulos on ABC's This Week. But when he came back a few days later, he said, I'd like to have it done at the end of my first term. So it gives the impression that maybe they are going to take a harder look at this. On the other hand, the proof of the pudding is in the tasting, and what we're seeing with the so-called stimulus package indicates that there's not a lot of patience on those quarters, and they're playing with money like it's monopoly money, and so maybe they'd be willing to play with our security with the same sort of fast and loose aspect to it. I certainly hope not, though. I am hearing things through the grapevine that indicate that he's moving a lot slower on security, national security issues, than he has been on this economic stuff.
I'm just thinking that between the, I think 90 plus were released Saturday, I read, and in from Yemeni jails, mm-hmm. and they have maybe 90 more.
Yeah, Yemen is a revolving door, Pat. It's anybody who thinks that Yemen is on our side in this war against fundamental Islam is sadly mistaken. And if they think that Yemen's a solution, they're drinking their own bathwater, because Yemen is part of the problem, and we need to recognize that. I mean, just the sheer numbers alone. If we've got 240 guys still in Gitmo, and 100 of them are Yemenis, and the bulk of the remainder are Saudis, this ought to tell us something, just as, you know, the 15th to the 19th and 9/11 were Saudis, and the 20th was also a Saudi, and he's Mohammed al-Qahtani. He's still in Guantanamo. So, the, you know, these folks are not our friends. I think that one of the things that would be excellent background for a lot of the listeners, if they're interested in this and they want to pursue it further, is, you know, go ahead and read the book. Read Inside Gitmo. Read the stories that I recount in there, because I intentionally picked not only the some of the biggest players, but some of these bit players, too, just to paint this picture, because what we're looking at here is not a simple grassroots rural guerrilla movement that you might find in some backward third world country. It's an incredibly organized, highly financed, and very sophisticated organization that any CEO of an international corporation would be envious of the seamlessness with which these guys move money from country to country, the way that they will tap into Islamic charities, so-called, either here in the States or in Europe, and funnel that money into them and, you know, launder it many times. There's a guy in Guantanamo right now who actually was doing what we would call HR work for the jihadists. He was setting up retirement funds, insurance policies to take care of their families, all of these sorts of things, you know, medical benefits. It's mind-boggling.
So he's not just a sheep herder that got caught up in the battle.
No. These guys aren't sheep herders. Even Rich Khan, who wrote this very sycophantic book called My Guantanamo Diary, the detainees and the stories they told me, which I, by the way, reviewed for the New York Post a few months back. You know, even she admits, when she was speaking to this one guy she referred to as Taj, that, you know, she apparently bought his story that he was a goat herder, but then, on, you know, made the side comment that he was the most goat herder genius that she had ever met. And that's what these guys are. I mean, there's a, you know, Shakur Ami is a one of the local, you know, one of the self-proclaimed leaders down there. Shakur has got a master's degree in electrical engineering, you know, the hardest of the engineering disciplines, from Purdue.
Wow.
There are two guys down there who have advanced degrees in economics from the London School of Economics. There are several who have graduated from Emory-Riddle University here in the United States with pilot's licenses. There are others who have, there's two pharmacists, there's a physician, there's an LSU graduate, you know, the list goes on and on. And I think it's critical, one of the points I make in the book is that we have been told often, particularly by the anti-Gitmo people, that, you know, these are all innocents, they're mostly uneducated, they're very simple-minded people who couldn't have been doing the kinds of things we're talking about. There's no intelligence information that's ever come out of there that's been valuable, and that there's no real reason to continue to keep them, because they're just, you know, kind of dumb privates in this organization, if you will. And actually, the reverse is true. There are some really extraordinarily brilliant individuals down there. Shakur Ami, the electrical engineer I refer to, has actually been voluntarily talking for years, and he brags about how he trained bomb makers to, you know, that are now active in Afghanistan and Iraq and are now training, you know, their successors. So we've actually been able to learn a lot, for example, about defeating IEDs from this guy because of the things he's told us. One of the things I was going to say, apropos to Rich's comment about the letter writing and that sort of thing, is that please feel free, particularly on these Guantanamo issues, to go to InsideGitmo.com, because we've got a huge resource there that's intended for exactly this purpose. In other words, it's a lot stronger when people get these letters if they're not just saying, I don't want Guantanamo detainees here, no, 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 but if they come up and say things like, you know, they'll give reasons for it and say, you know, that, you know, like the medical side of things and the, you know, the commitment to the jihad that these guys have and the fact that it'll be a magnet wherever they land in the United States for other jihadists to come and probably, and, you know, I hope I'm being pessimistic, but I would think that we place our local communities in jeopardy with this because we've seen how these guys operate in places like Russia, Beslan, Russia, and in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Yemen, where they're perfectly content to take the civilian populace hostage or in many cases to murder them outright simply to make a point. And if you can, you know, glean something off the website and put that in the letter, even reference a website, you know, what the heck, and, you know, to give the Congress people or the, you know, the other elected officials some ammo to go on, then it makes it that much stronger. And, you know, they see that this is, these are thoughtful op-eds, thoughtful letters to the editor, thoughtful letters, and the they'll react more strongly, trust me. They, you know, they're, in many cases, one of the reasons I think, for example, that so many Democrats broke with Nancy Pelosi in the House and moved over to vote against this bill was because of constituent pressure. And we can raise that same kind of constituent pressure on Guantanamo, continue to make it an issue. I think it ought to be an election issue if it drags out into 2010.
Oh, I can only hope it drags out to 2010 with the possibility looming that we'll get hit again due to sheer stupidity.
Yeah, I think that that's there, and I think that the more we bring these guys into the States, I mean, right now they're in a place that's safe. Nobody's escaped. Nobody's attacked. We bring them here, and we run the risk of these, you know, these attacks by these crazies. And also, I mean, not to mention demonstrations, you know, by ACLU and other organizations that are determined to release them into U.S. soil. But the fact that they may, in fact, be released into U.S. soil, and I just think it's too risky. And if we get together on this and make a concerted effort, drag, you know, force this issue to be debated, force hearings in Congress, make it drag out as long as possible, because the longer we keep them down there, the safer we are. One of the things that scares me is that Barney Frank, who has already stated, well, gee, if we can do 10, we can probably do 25. And Rahm Emanuel has said publicly that if we can, you know, that what he's looking at is by the end of this first term, a 40% cut in defense budget. And this is at a time when, you know, the president is actually talking about moving more soldiers to Iraq, I mean, to Afghanistan. And we're having our supply routes cut out from under us there. To cut systems, to cut soldiers, to cut benefits, I think is just in an era when we're throwing money off the back of the wagon like the Joker in Batman, I think is just crazy. And it does show, I fear, where the priorities of this administration lie.
I heard, what's his name, Barney Frank, wanted 25% way back.
Yeah, that's right.
He seems to be doing a lot of the leading scary thought.
Well, it is a scary thought, and I think that's what happens when you have inexperience in at the top, is that the more versatile players in Washington, the ones who have been around a while and know where the bodies are buried and how to make things happen, are going to fill the vacuum. And we saw that on the economic package where, you know, the order from the White House was just get it done, and so everybody in Congress piled on. And I suspect we're going to see the same thing with the defense budget and with veterans measures and this sort of thing. And it's got me very concerned. I've written several times that I think the services, particularly the Guard and the Reserves, are overstretched. I mean, I've seen it in Iraq. I've seen it in Guantanamo. Seen it talking to these people back here. And the to put further burden on the manpower is just absolutely nuts, not to mention, you know, maintenance, equipment. You know, we're not broken, but we're stretched awfully thin right now.
They were talking about, somebody was talking about bringing back the draft. And my husband is a veteran of 26 years in the Air Force, and my brother is a veteran of the Army and the Air Force, and they are both just, you know, banging their heads against the wall saying, if they want to reinstate the draft, we're going to get a bunch of losers who don't want to be there, and it would be very bad for us. Meanwhile, if they would just stimulate the military, keep supporting the military, we would have the force that we have now, only better, because those people want to be there.
Oh yeah, it's I was in the post-Vietnam Army. I was in the pre-Vietnam or the Vietnam Army too, and one of the things that we went through with this transition was exactly that. We went from having to deal with a lot of young people who didn't want to be there to those who did. I've said on several occasions, this is the finest military that we've ever fielded, and we need to be proud of them. We don't need to go back to something like conscription. And the ones who are presenting this, people like Charlie Rangel, you know, who's ought to be indicted himself, and others are simply doing this. This is a trick. It's a gambit. They don't want to see the draft back. What they want to see is even more of a backlash against the military from their constituents.
Exactly.
So that they can use that as a tool to say, see, the American people don't support the military, therefore we really ought to come.
And one of the things I wanted to ask you was, when we look at, you mentioned a guy that was bragging about training. There's 90 seconds, I just heard my little ear. One of the people that you talked about, Colonel, that was bragging about training people, it was he responsible for training the dirty bomber that you mentioned in your book?
He may have been. It's hard to do exact links with these guys, but certainly, Padilla, Jose Padilla and Binyam Muhammad and others trained in these camps in Afghanistan, and they were definitely looking at a dirty bomb strike in the United States, absolutely.
It's interesting that I just don't understand how they're going to explain it away when we are attacked, when the guys that are they want to let out of Gitmo now join up with the guys from Yemen and create the super group, like we're not going to be attacked?
Well, of course we are. I mean, that's the whole idea of this thing. I think we're fortunate that we weren't attacked in the 7 years following 9/11, and a lot of that came as you know, you and other readers of the book have discovered through some of the intelligence information that was gathered through interrogations at Guantanamo. So, you know, this has been a very valuable resource for us, and to close it arbitrarily or to let these guys loose, I think, is, just simply asking for trouble and opening ourselves up for another strike. Right, InsideGitmo.com, and it's a companion to the book, of course. The concept of this whole thing is new in publishing, Rich, is that we've got over 500 citations in the book, and it just seemed that it would make a lot of sense to have the documents that we cited in the book available for the reader. And obviously, I mean, some of these are like a 438-page FBI report. You're not going to have that in a published work, or it's going to come out looking like the Encyclopedia Britannica. So what could we do? Well, you know, the web is a great tool for this, and so we posted the Inside Gitmo website and refer to it in-house as the living book, because we can continue to update it, which we do on a daily basis. We can continue to have discussion groups, which I would love for you all to join, where we talk about these topics, and so that people can come in, they can read them. They can see what, you know, what's on other people's minds, what our thoughts are. You know, I do a blog on there. We'll have articles like not only the few that I write, but the many that are out there right now and available that we can, you know, with people who are keeping up with this, not only in this country and Canada, but around the world. And so it's a huge resource, and that was what I was referring to earlier when I said that anybody who wants to follow your advice, and I think everybody should, to get involved, to get smart and educated on this subject, and then to take action, to write articles, write pieces, send letters, and, you know, use the website and the book as resources to back up what you say, because when you can do that, it just adds a lot of credibility to what you put out there.
Well, let me ask you, for a letter to the editor to say why we should keep Gitmo open, can you give me maybe three bullets right now? I mean, I'll go to your website, and I'm sure I can probably find three bullets, but if you don't mind.
Absolutely. I think the first one is that the enemy combatants there have been given safe and humane treatment, and it's well documented. You know, the corollary of that is that no one's been tortured and abused there other than the American soldiers, who are constantly subject to abuse by the detainees. Second point would be that the amount of intelligence information that's come out of Gitmo and continues to come out of Gitmo, that's the important point. This isn't something that stopped a long time ago. It's going on a daily basis, is of a strategic level. It's enabling us to dismantle these organizations where it hurts them the most, and money laundering and transfer and organization and recruiting, all that sort of thing. And then I think third and most important is that these are committed jihadists. These are our sworn enemies, and keeping them off the battlefield in a time of war is a major is of major value to this country and is completely authorized under any conventions that were signed, including Geneva.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you one thing about this Minam Mohammadan. You know, you see all the publicity, and I know you write about it in your book, and one maybe for the benefit of the folks here is to talk a little bit about that publicity and where it's coming from that's, you know, bringing their jihadists, to bring our jihadists home. And this guy's a dirty bomber. He's going to be, sounds like he's going to be coming home to London.
Yeah, it's very scary. And I think one of the things that's got me really upset, too, is this the behavior of this military attorney, Air Force Lieutenant Colonel Yvonne Bradley, who just recently, I mean, it's been just the last few weeks, has acted as a one-woman foreign policy department for the United States. And I mean, I can understand a civilian attorney doing everything that he or she could do to defend a client. But it just seems to me that there's an ethical line that's been crossed here. And by the way, this is a topic on our discussion group, if any of y'all would like to join it on the website, because I'm really nonplussed by this. I mean, I, as a former serving officer and, you know, being in contact with veterans and troops and who are serving today, I just find this incomprehensible that someone in uniform can go to the UK, pay a personal call on the foreign minister on behalf of her client, who's being held by her government, make these egregious statements in public about, you know, the rendition and torture and all of this stuff, which, if she doesn't know, if she knows it's false and is saying it, is an outright lie. And if she doesn't know it's false and thinks it's true, then, you know, she's extraordinarily naive. So it just bothers me no end to see someone in uniform doing this. She even sent a personal letter to Obama. And, I'm asking, where is the chain of command? Where is discipline in this case?
Ooh,
and
isn't she following our elected officials who've done the same thing?
Yeah, but it's a little bit of a different thing when you're talking about a uniformed officer. There's a point where you cross into conduct unbecoming, and I think Major Murray ran into a little bit of that conversation with his boss while defending David Hicks.
That's correct. And there is a difference. I mean, although candidly, I think that you know, elected officials that go on their own, and for example, like that bunch that went to visit Saddam Hussein right before Operation Iraqi Freedom kicked off. I just find that we allow this kind of stuff to be just incomprehensible. But we've done it since people like Jane Fonda and others went to North Vietnam and, you know, posed behind anti-aircraft guns. It really seems that in the Vietnam period, the rules of ethics and behavior and rule of law that was in place certainly during World War II went out the window, and they're still out the window. Can anybody imagine that's on this conversation or listening to this podcast what would have happened if a serving senator or congressman visited Adolf Hitler or Tojo, you know, say prior to December 7th or even afterwards, or if a uniformed military began to advocate strongly on behalf of the either of those governments without any sort of permission. I mean, they would have ended up under the jail.
That was exactly my point, Colonel. That was exactly what I was trying to say. But when you've got elected officials, and I believe they also take an oath, don't they?
Oh, yeah, but it doesn't seem to matter a whole hell of a lot.
Going out and doing that, it's – I'm not defending it. Believe me, I'm not even coming close to defending it, but it's like, you know, these are the elected folks, and they're doing it. So, but I agree with you, when you're in uniform – it's a whole nother kettle of fish.
Well, you know, even the uniformed people get away with it, Laurie, but the elected officials get away with it. But at the same time, as Tim and other veterans will tell you, you know, when you put on the suit, you hold yourself to higher standards, or at least you're supposed to. And when I see what a lot of these soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen are going through on a daily basis, and to see what we hear coming out of Capitol Hill or from some of these other sources, it just stuns me, frankly. The callousness, the obvious neglect of the facts, or in some cases, I think it's cognitive dissonance. They just don't want to know the truth, and
exactly,
so that they can continue on their own political agenda.
Amen. Well, thank you, everyone, especially you, Carl, for being with us once again.
And, my pleasure, as always, guys.
Everything you're doing, and enjoy your cigar.
Thank you, guys.
And have a
good
evening.
Thank you, Colonel.
Thank you, everyone, for making our first nightcap so much fun.
Night,
everybody.